Have you ever stood at an air show and watched 100,000 people look up at the same time? That feeling, that collective gasp, that moment when gravity seems negotiable, that started somewhere. And I mean the very first time Americans saw it happen on a grand scale. I'm Tail Dragger and you're listening to The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Pull up a chair, because this story starts in a bean field south of Los Angeles in January of 1910. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSold.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up, if you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at aviationsold.com. Now you have to understand what the world looked like at the start of 1910. The Wright brothers had flown at Kitty Hawk only 6 years earlier. 6 years. Most Americans had never seen an airplane. Not in person. They had read about them in the papers, sure, maybe seen a grainy photograph. But the idea of a machine carrying a man through the air was still closer to magic than science for most folks. Automobiles were still a novelty. Horses still outnumbered cars on most roads. And here comes this group of businessmen in Los Angeles who decide they are going to put on an aviation meet to rival anything Europe has ever seen. See, the French had already held their big event at Reims the summer before. The Grande Semaine d'Aviation, it was a sensation. And a wealthy aviation enthusiast named Dick Ferris looked at what the French had done and said, "We can do that here. We can do it bigger. We can do it in California, where the weather is perfect and the land is flat, and the whole country will pay attention." They found their spot on the Dominguez Ranch, a sprawling piece of farmland about 15 miles south of downtown Los Angeles. The Dominguez family had owned that land since a Spanish land grant back in the 1700s. And now, in the first month of a brand new decade, their bean fields were about to become the stage for something nobody in America had ever seen before. The organizers laid out a course. They built grandstands, they sold tickets, and they brought in the best aviators money could attract. This was not some county fair sideshow. This was a world-class competition with real prize money. $20,000 total, which in 1910 was a fortune. You could buy a house for $1,000. They were offering 20 times that. The two headliners were Glenn Curtis and Louis Paulhan. Now here's where it gets interesting, because these two men represented completely different worlds of flight. Glenn Curtis was the American, a motorcycle racer from Hammondsport, New York, who had gotten into aviation through engine building. He was lean, quiet, intense. He had already won the Gordon Bennett Trophy at Reims the year before, flying faster than anyone else in the world at the time, 47 miles per hour. That was the speed record, 47, and people thought that was breathtaking. Louis Paulhan was the Frenchman, a former balloon mechanic who had taught himself to fly on a Voisin biplane and then moved up to a Farman and a Blériot. He was flamboyant, charming, a natural showman. The crowd loved him the minute he stepped off the train. He brought his wife, and she became a celebrity in her own right, cheering from the edge of the field in Parisian fashion while her husband defied gravity overhead. The meet opened on January 10, 1910, and the weather cooperated beautifully. Clear skies, light winds, the San Gabriel Mountains standing sharp against the horizon. The grandstands were packed, but here's the part that still gets me. The crowd was not just in the grandstands. People came from everywhere. They came on the Pacific Electric Red cars, the interurban rail line that ran right out to the ranch. They came in automobiles, in horse-drawn carriages, on bicycles, on foot. Estimates vary, but over the 11 days of the meet, somewhere between 200,000 and a half million people showed up, the largest crowds that had ever gathered for any event in the history of Southern California. And what did they see? They saw flight. Real, honest to goodness, engines running, wheels leaving the ground flight. For most of them, it was the first time. Think about that for a second. Imagine you have lived your entire life with your feet on the ground. Every human you have ever known has lived with their feet on the ground. Every generation before you, going back to the beginning of time, feet on the ground. And then you stand in a bean field in Dominguez, and you hear this rattling, clattering, coughing engine wind up to speed, and a contraption made of wood and fabric and wire starts rolling across the dirt. And then, impossibly, it lifts. It just lifts off the earth and climbs into the sky. The sound of that engine getting smaller as it rises, the shadow crossing the field, the way the wires sing in the wind. People wept. Grown men took off their hats and stood there with their mouths open. Children screamed with joy. Reporters wrote that the crowd went mad. Curtis flew his pusher biplane, the machine that had won at Reims. It was fragile looking, all bamboo and spruce and muslin stretched tight. No fuselage to speak of. Just the pilot sitting out there on a little seat ahead of the engine, with nothing between him and the sky but his own nerve. He flew fast and low and precise. That was his style. No wasted motion. Everything calculated. He won the speed events easily, reaching just over 55 miles per hour, which set a new American record right there in front of the crowd. But Paul Hunn? Paul Hunn was the one who stole the show. And he did it by going up. On January 12th, Paul Hunn took off in his Henry Farman biplane and just kept climbing. The crowd tilted their heads back. He rose past the grandstands, past the eucalyptus trees at the edge of the ranch, past the rooftops of the nearby towns. He climbed until he was a speck against the blue California sky when he finally brought the Farman back down. The barograph strapped to his strut read 4,165 feet. That was the new altitude record for the entire Western Hemisphere. Nobody in the Americas had ever been that high in an airplane. But Paul Hunn wasn't done. He had heard about a $20,000 prize for the longest cross-country flight of the meet, and he wanted it. On January 20th, he took off from Dominguez and headed toward a balloon tethered near a place called Arcadia, near the base of the San Gabriel Mountains. Then he turned around and came back. The round trip was just under 46 miles. It does not sound like much today. You can drive it in 40 minutes, but in 1910, in a Farman biplane, with a 50-horsepower Gnome rotary engine and no instruments besides a compass and his own eyesight, it was an epic voyage. He flew over farms and towns and roads full of people who stopped whatever they were doing and looked up and pointed and cheered. He followed the Pacific Electric tracks for navigation. The same rail line that had brought the crowd to the field was now his highway in the sky. When he landed back at Dominguez, the crowd surged past the barriers. They wanted to touch him, to shake his hand, to be near this man who had just flown across the landscape they knew from the ground and seen it from the sky. Now, I mentioned there was real drama at this meet, and it went beyond the flying. The Wright brothers were not there. They had refused to participate. But more than that, they were at war with Glenn Curtiss over patents. The Wrights claimed their patent covered the concept of lateral control through wing warping, and they argued that Curtiss's use of ailerons, those hinged surfaces on the wings, infringed on their patent. They had already gotten an injunction against Curtiss in New York, and their lawyers were circling the Los Angeles meet like buzzards over a thermal. In fact, during the meet itself, a process server showed up at the field with papers for Paul Hunn, because the Wrights claimed his Farman biplane also infringed on their patents. Paul Hunn's team managed to dodge the server for a while, but the legal shadow hung over the entire event. Here you had this magnificent celebration of flight, this moment when 250,000 Americans were falling in love with the airplane for the first time, and behind the scenes, lawyers were trying to shut it down. Some things about aviation never change, I suppose. But the meet also gave us something else. Something quieter, but maybe more important. It gave us the first real stirring of what air shows would become. Because the organizers figured out very quickly that people did not just want to see airplanes fly in circles. They wanted spectacle. They wanted the gasp. They wanted to feel the danger and the beauty at the same time. So there were races. Speed dashes back and forth past the grandstands. Engines screaming. The smell of castor oil and exhaust drifting over the crowd. There were altitude attempts where the airplanes would climb until the audience could barely see them. There was a dirigible that lumbered around the course like a whale trying to keep up with dolphins. And there was a young aviator named Charles Willard who took his Curtiss pusher up and made what the newspapers called daring maneuvers, steep banks and sharp turns that had the crowd gasping. One reporter from the Los Angeles Herald wrote, and I love this line, he wrote that watching the airplanes was like watching a new kind of creature take its first breath, that the machines were alive and the men who flew them were part of something the world had never contained before. That is beautiful writing, and it captured something real. The meet ran from January 10th through the 20th, 11 days when it was over, America had changed. Not in some dramatic headline-screaming way, but in a deep, quiet, permanent way. Hundreds of thousands of people had seen airplanes fly. They had heard the engines, they had smelled the exhaust, they had felt the vibration in their chests when a biplane buzzed the grandstands, and they went home and told everyone they knew. Within a year, aviation meets were springing up across the country. Barnstormers started working the circuit. Airplane manufacturers saw the business potential. The Army, which had been skeptical about aviation, started paying closer attention after military officers attended the Dominguez meet and watched Curtiss demonstrate the potential of the airplane as a reconnaissance platform. And the Dominguez ranch itself? It went back to being farmland for a while. Then industry moved in. Today, the site is covered by the neighborhoods and businesses of the city of Carson, California. There is a historical marker, there is a small park. Most people who live there have no idea that beneath their feet is the ground where America watched its first great air show and decided that the sky was worth reaching for. That bean field, that is where it started. Not the invention of flight that happened at Kitty Hawk, but the love of flight. The public, passionate, shared love of watching an airplane do something impossible that was born at Dominguez in the California sunshine in January of 1910. The Dominguez Air Meet is one of those stories that deserves to be better known. And if you want to dig deeper, the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum archives and the Dominguez Rancho Adobe Museum both have wonderful material on it. You can find more stories like this at RadioHanger.com. I'm Tail Dragger. Next time you're standing at an air show with your neck craned back, remember you're doing exactly what 250,000 Californians did in a bean field 116 years ago. Blue skies, friends.